Brexit, more Brexit, and Kevin Durant, just for good measure. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, the 5th of July. Hope you had a good holiday. Fallout from Brexit continued. Today, the Bank of England announced it's cutting capital requirements for UK banks. Yep, cutting. If that feels counterintuitive, the message from Bank of England Governor Mark Carney was yes. Some of the risks from Brexit have begun to crystallize. But he said the bank has a clear plan and it's working. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes a look at that plan.
After the financial crisis, there was a lot of focus on raising the amount of money banks had to set aside for a rainy day. And in the UK?
It's clear that it is raining right now.
Bart Van Ark, chief economist at the Conference Board, says this move, cutting capital requirements, is to try and prevent bigger storms on the horizon. So in general, when it comes to these capital requirements, there's the ordinary, always there pool of money to make sure banks can keep functioning in tough times. But what the BOE cut today is a new extra layer on top that changes based on what the economy's doing.
Basically build up capital in good times in order to use it in bad times.
This is called, brace yourself, counter-cyclical capital buffers. Lucia Qualia is a professor at the University of York in the UK.
The decision to lower counter-cyclical capital requirements was designed to free capital, about 150 billion sterling.
Almost $200 billion.
For lending to the real economy, by which I mean credit supply to household and business.
To improve business confidence and, hopefully, keep the economy growing. That's the idea.
I think there's a lot of question as to whether this will actually work.
James Kwok with the University of Connecticut School of Law.
Reducing capital requirements essentially makes it possible for banks to lend more, but there's no particular reason to believe that they will, especially if there's a lot of anxiety about the financial situation.
Eight major UK banks released a statement today saying they would lend. But the other side of this is that people and businesses have to want to borrow. And they might look at the UK economy and think, nah, I'll sit tight for now. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Brexit, turns out, is being closely followed in India. India today is one of the biggest investors in the UK. More than 800 Indian companies are based there. Recently, Indian firms have snapped up iconic British brands such as Jaguar, Land Rover, and Tetley Tea. The BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar checked in on what Brexit might mean for India.
Drive through any major Indian city, and Britain's influence over its former colony is almost immediately apparent. From the colonial-style architecture to the street names to the widespread use of the English language. These days, though, to get a sense of the contemporary relationship, perhaps the best place to come to is a shopping mall like the one I'm in. And you're surrounded by some of the biggest names in British business. From Marks & Spencer's to Burberry, Accessorize, Next, Mothercare, Costa Coffee, they're all here. So I've just come to a cafe and I'm joined here by Suhasini Haider. She's diplomatic editor with one of India's biggest national dailies, the Hindu newspaper. What does India make of Brexit, do you think?
India certainly woke up with a certain amount of shock, just like the UK did, that this had actually gone through. But I don't think people are surprised by some of the sentiments that have been expressed by the people choosing to leave.
Many in India also think Brexit could lead to business opportunities for one of the world's fastest growing economies, especially as it's been struggling in recent years to sign a free trade agreement with Europe. Swapan Dasgupta is a member of parliament from the governing BJP party.
You see, one of the biggest hindrances that India had with the EU was in negotiating the FTA, because it was a maddening experience, partly because of the multiplicity of demands. Trying to get a trade agreement with Britain is a far more manageable proposition. To that extent, I think it is welcome for India.
India is also one of Britain's biggest investors, but has often complained that it's hampered by labour laws, which make it easier for European immigrants to find work. Arch Chandrasekhar is the president of India's main body for its software and IT industry.
The current arrangements in which movement of skilled persons from within the EU was on a much higher pedestal than movement of skilled persons from other geographies which were otherwise very important in this sector, like India. It's now a level playing field in terms of access to talent.
The growing influence of the British Indian community is another reason for the country's optimism, as Suhasini Haider explains.
Indian community sees itself as an integral part of British society. They see themselves in Parliament. They see themselves running some of the most successful businesses in the UK, and somehow have decided that this Brexit feeling is not something aimed at them. It's aimed perhaps at East European immigrants, or the sense that they are taking away jobs from other British citizens.
All of this means that India is willing to offer a helping hand to the UK at this critical and uncertain time, while recognizing there are substantial benefits for it as well.
That was the BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar. Here on Wall Street, traders weren't seeing as much of a Brexit upside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Last week, we released our Marketplace Edison Research Economic Poll. It's the third installment of our national economic survey, gauging how Americans feel about the state of the economy and the state of their personal economies. What we found this time around is that anxiety is up over the last time we checked, back in March. And as we get closer to the presidential election, questions about economic security are only going to matter more. We asked Marketplace's Mark Garrison to check into one specific group of voters and what they want to hear from the candidates.
Small businesses are responsible for two-thirds of new job growth, meaning what affects them has big consequences for our whole economy. Talk to a few entrepreneurs and you'll quickly notice a theme in how they talk about Washington. Brenda Jones-Barwick runs an Oklahoma City PR company.
Politicians do not understand small business and do not understand what is stifling small businesses and slowing the growth of our economy.
And here's Nancy Aber-Gasho, co-owner of a New York architecture firm.
Everyone says that small business is the engine of our economy. But right now, the engine needs gas. We need fuel.
She's a Hillary Clinton supporter. The first voice backs Donald Trump. Like a lot of small business owners, they have a shared frustration with national politics, even as their personal political views vary. As far as specific issues, access to capital is a common concern. Bank lending locked up in the wake of the recession, meaning successful small businesses had trouble getting loans to grow more. And one of the most common policy topics small business owners worry about is health insurance.
Historically, we've offered a pretty rich benefit plan, or at least it started out as a pretty rich plan.
Gary Kushner has an HR consulting firm based in Michigan. The Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, exempts businesses with fewer than 50 employees from key provisions. That includes all the companies we talked to in this story. But remember, large and small companies often go after the same talent. Small businesses struggle to offer benefit plans that compete with big corporate packages.
Many small employers would love to provide rich health benefits as a recruiting and retention tool, and yet the costs of those have gone up pretty substantially, much faster than the rate of pay.
Small businesses want action on health care in Washington, but whether that means reforming or replacing Obamacare varies depending on which business owner you talk to. America's small business scene is diverse politically, but also in terms of industry. It's far bigger than the coffee shop or landscaping companies that come to mind when people think small business. The community includes the professional services companies we just heard from and the company that created this. That's a sanding tool made by Temple Allen Industries in Maryland. Has only a dozen employees, but sells to big clients.
We have equipment at Boeing, at Airbus, Northrop Grumman, at Lockheed.
That's Temple Allen co-founder Robert Kent. Some of his company's sanders are sold overseas. Small businesses that export want to see more support and less red tape.
So I'll wave my magic wand and simplify the tax code and simplify, you know, export paperwork and simplify the administrative burden on everybody.
Companies of all sizes are concerned about taxes and regulations, but unlike big companies, small businesses don't have hordes of lawyers and accountants to wade through rules and paperwork. That stuff makes small businesses nuts, not just because it costs time and money, but because they're entrepreneurs. They want to do stuff, not push paper. So the ones we talk to don't tend to think highly of squabbling candidates in a dysfunctional Congress.
I'm not very optimistic that at the legislative level, there will be a lot done, which is disappointing, but I think that's just what the landscape looks like.
Small business is something just about all politicians say they support, like the troops or the middle class. But just like veterans frustrated with medical care backlogs and working parents scraping to pay for child care, the small business owners we talk to don't feel they're getting enough from Washington beyond warm words and campaign speeches. And there's more at stake here than business and economics. Jeffrey Robinson is a Rutgers business professor who works with entrepreneurs.
They're the ones who are sponsoring the Little League teams. They're the ones who are giving donations to the school. It's not just job creation. It's about what small business owners do in their local communities.
And they will keep doing it, no matter who controls the White House and Congress. But they sure would appreciate it if all the nice things politicians say about small business actually lead to some action. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Kai's out, but we've still got the latest episode of our Corner Office podcast. Kai talks to Chris Melendondri, who founded Illumination Entertainment, the company behind the Minions. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. You could almost hear the frustration of basketball fans around the country, except for those in Northern California, when Kevin Durant announced he'll sign with the Golden State Warriors. The contract is reportedly a two-year, $54 million deal. But Durant is far from the only player raking it in this free agency period. From starters to bench warmers, this year's free agents are seeing record contracts, thanks to a surge in television revenue for the NBA. For more, we've got Wayne McDonald. He's academic chair of sports management at NYU's Tisch Sports Institute. Great to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell me what's different about this free agency period.
Well, I think what's really different is the quality of the free agents that were available, as well as the price to which a lot of teams were more than willing to pay for free agents, particularly what we saw over the first 24 hours once July 1st hit, that teams were willing to spend up to $2 billion on approximately 29 free agents, which was simply remarkable when you think about it.
With so many teams this year able to offer these huge contracts, how else are they competing for top-tier talent?
Well, we heard with Steve Ballmer with the Clippers, what he tried to sell to Kevin Durant was the market and the off-the-court opportunities for finance and business ventures. So I think what we've seen, you know, particularly in the Hamptons this past weekend with all the different people going to visit with Kevin Durant, the Celtics brought Tom Brady. So you're selling a lot of different things. Not only are you selling the on-court product, you're selling the franchise, you're selling the city, you're selling the fans in a lot of cases, but most importantly, the extracurricular activities to help make these extraordinarily wealthy athletes even more wealthy.
I want to ask another question about this free agency period, which is we've seen a lot of sort of mid-level players get enormous contracts, sometimes contracts that are as high as really top-tier level players who aren't in a free agents this time around. What's that going to mean for teams and sort of the imbalance of pay on teams this next season?
I think that's perplexing a lot of people. When the NBA experts and the men and women who covered the game on a daily basis are shaking their heads at these deals and the types of contracts certain players are getting, we saw nine-figure contracts go to many players that most average NBA fans weren't even aware even existed.
I didn't know their names.
And you know, we thought it was only going to be Kevin Durant and Dwight Howard and Dwayne Wade and players like that. But, you know, it's going deeper and it just speaks volumes to the amount of money that's in the game right now.
What conversations do you think other pro athletes are having about all of this today?
Well, I think NFL players are very upset at both the NBA and Major League Baseball, particularly their unions, because they've done an excellent job of getting guaranteed money for their constituents. So I think the NFL players are probably looking not jealous, but just upset of the fact that, you know, a top flight player like an Andrew Luck is getting a $140 million deal. And a middle-tier NBA player is making that money as well. So there is clearly a disparity, but you got to applaud the unions of both the NBA and MLB for doing great work for their constituents.
Wayne McDonald is Academic Chair of Sports Management at NYU's Tisch Sports Institute. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up,
pipelines really are like underground energy highways.
Energy highways with a cost. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 108.6% to close at 17,840. The Nasdaq fell 39.8% to finish at 4822. The S&P 500 was down 14.6%, closing at 2088. Everything babies today. Destination Maternity down 3%. The Children's Place, which calls itself a pure play children's specialty apparel retailer, up 0.6%. Carter's, which brings you Carter's and Oshkosh, off 1%. Mothercare, a British retailer, they get their nappies and prams there, down 0.3% on the London Exchange. And then there's the brainchild of Victor Mills, a Procter & Gamble researcher who disliked changing his grandchild's cloth diapers. The result in 1961? Pampers. Procter & Gamble up 0.75%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to a record low 1.37%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Zika is moving fast, but Congress, not so much. A political fight has stalled funding to help combat the spread of the virus over, it turns out, contraception. Democrats and Republicans are deadlocked over whether the $1 billion Zika fund could be used by private family planning clinics like Planned Parenthood. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The bill provides Zika money through a grant that private clinics like Planned Parenthood cannot tap. Those are often the main places women go for contraception services, says University of Pittsburgh epidemiologist Jennifer Nuzzo. There's evidence globally now that Zika is sexually transmitted, and by far the most cases in the U.S. are in Puerto Rico.
We basically want all of the places where people generally seek care to be able to provide the care that's necessary. In the context of Puerto Rico, the Puerto Rican version of Planned Parenthood, if that's where they go.
This is where the specialists are, she says, and cutting off those clinics would severely limit women's access and potentially let more of the virus spread. That's the upshot of this ideological fight. Peter Shin teaches health policy at George Washington University.
States are potentially going to be having to pick up the cost later, when you have the Zika-related illnesses. So you can talk about $1 billion now, or you can be talking about tens of billion dollars down the road.
A promising Zika vaccine trial is also underway. Dr. Anthony Fauci runs the arm of the NIH developing a vaccine, but says it could run out of money.
That will be really unfortunate because not only would it interfere with the timetable, but we would then have to probably use whatever money that we've been borrowing from other areas to even keep the program alive.
If Congress is nowhere on this by the end of next week, it's scheduled to brick till September. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You may have noticed Amazon has started to drop list prices. You know, the posted original price that makes us feel good about scoring a deal. It could be that the online retailer is trying to make sure it's not at risk of being accused of false advertising. Or maybe Amazon isn't trying to sell us on low prices the same way it used to. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Academics and psychologists have studied the excitement of getting a bargain for years. You feel smart for buying something at a discount. Feels like you're getting one over on the retailer. But what if that price is just made up?
List price is a useful fiction that was designed to establish comparison.
John Rand is Senior Vice President of Market Insights at Kantar Retail. He says getting rid of them is overdue, and in some ways it's just retailers catching up with the times.
Why bother when anyone who wants to can search a price anyway?
That is, online. And if you're making up those list prices, nowadays consumers can find evidence online and document it. That's led to lawsuits for companies like JCPenney and Overstock. Or, if you feel like you're getting tricked, you might tweet about it or post it on your Facebook page. Sundar Bharadwaj is a professor of marketing at the University of Georgia.
So the consumers have a megaphone now. It's not like in the past. And that might lead to bad PR for firms.
He says that's a big deal, especially for online retailers. Amazon is trying to be the one-stop shop for basically everything a consumer needs. Richard Feinberg teaches retail management at Purdue University. He says for Amazon, getting rid of the list price is more about consumer loyalty than anything else.
Consumers are just not going to break out of Amazon, go to the Google, and search for that price.
He says a lot of consumers are now buying things more out of convenience than price. But getting rid of the list price could just be an experiment. After all, Amazon has access to a lot of data, and it'll be the first to see if that feeling of getting a bargain really was the key to its success. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
More than 2 months after a natural gas pipeline exploded outside of Pittsburgh, investigators still have no final report on the cause. But the explosion has intensified the debate over building more of these pipelines. Reed Frazier of the Allegheny Front reports.
A tornado, a giant storm, an airplane crashing. That's how neighbors describe the sound of the explosion that took place at 8:13 a.m. on April 29th in a field in western Pennsylvania.
It was sickening, the rushing noise from the oxygen coming in, and it consumed all the oxygen around here. It had double the time breathing.
Dave Allen lives down the road from where the blast occurred, but he says the explosion doesn't make him worry about the potential for other mishaps with pipelines in the area.
They're constantly putting in pipelines, and they're relatively safe. There's a lot worse things to be worried about than gas explosions, believe me.
Investigators released a preliminary report that said corrosion along a weld in the 30-inch pipeline may have caused it to rupture. The pipeline is part of the Texas Eastern Transmission Line, a 9,000-mile system of pipes that transports natural gas north from the Gulf Coast to the eastern seaboard. Brigham McCown used to head up the federal agency in charge of pipeline safety.
Pipelines really are like underground energy highways. Some of them are interstates, some of them are rural country roads.
And the Texas Eastern Pipeline is like an interstate highway. McCown says 2.6 million miles of pipelines around the country carry oil and gas every day, almost always without incident. He says any type of energy transport, like trains or trucks, carries risk.
To the extent that pipelines aren't used, then other forms of transportation are used that are frankly far more dangerous.
But accidents do happen. Over the past decade, there have been more than 300 serious incidents involving pipelines, resulting in 132 deaths. These can often take place close to where people live. As safety advocates like to point out, there's no minimal setback for pipelines from homes and buildings established by the federal government. The explosion in western Pennsylvania took place 200 yards behind a house. 26-year-old James Baker fled the home just before it was engulfed in flames. He suffered third-degree burns on three-quarters of his body. The explosion was heard 2 miles away by Dean Law. He initially thought it was a nearby compressor station letting gas out of its pipes.
And then it kept going for about 10 minutes. I said, that doesn't sound right to me.
I met Law in his kitchen, where he explained that for 2.5 years, he fought Sunoco Logistics about allowing a pipeline on his property. He finally agreed to accept the company's offer after Sunoco threatened to use eminent domain. But he's not happy about it. Among his main concerns, the pipeline cuts right through a mobile home park he built on his property and will pass a few feet from the houses of his tenants. One of those is his own daughter, Dawn Law.
Over here, you can see where they've taken the other property owner's trees out up to our property line.
They show me the right-of-way, which follows an older pipeline that was built in the 1930s on the land. The new pipeline will go right by Dawn's front door. The recent explosion has her worried for her own safety in the unlikely event of a similar accident.
Living this close to it, what chance do you have? You don't have a chance.
If you're there, you're gone, that's all.
Dean Law doubts that'll ever happen on his property. But he says more pipelines means a higher chance for accidents. And with the recent drilling boom, he sees more pipelines in the future. In western Pennsylvania, I'm Reed Frazier for Marketplace.
This final note before we go, the box office made a kerplunk sound this weekend. Steven Spielberg's The BFG outright bombed, and The Legend of Tarzan struggled along. But a big budget movie fizzling out isn't unique. What's more interesting about Tarzan is one of the marketing strategies behind it. Warner Brothers created a six-week YouTube fitness tutorial so we can all have Tarzan-style abs, or at least a very rough approximation of Tarzan's abs. According to The Wrap, the videos were designed to appeal to the less-than-fit consumer. Each video is about 3 minutes long, which I think we can safely bet is significantly less time than the actor spent working on his own six-pack. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 108 points, 0.6%. The Nasdaq fell 39 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 was down 14 points, 0.6%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.